If you enjoyed this program, please sign up for our podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com.
We tend to harvest at least 2 weeks in advance compared to like 20 years ago, for example.
To farm 128 acres of wine grapes here, we need about 30 people. It's a labor-intensive industry.
No doubt about it. The easy part in the wine business is actually making the wines, however, selling it and branding it. That's a completely different story.
We've done more single vineyard calves, and it's really been the vineyard telling us where to go more than us saying, oh, we want to do single vineyard calves.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 423. This week we feature Chris Brundrett of William Chris Vineyards in High, Texas. The state of Texas is making quite a name for itself in winemaking as well as wine tourism. For this podcast, we return to Texas to chat with William Chris Vineyards Director of Winemaking and co-founder, Chris Brundrett. William Chris is found in High, Texas, not far from Austin and San Antonio, making for scenic travel. The United States is a major force in the wine world, and the state of Texas is slowly working its way to the top. You can also hear Chris on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term desert sage. So we're back in Texas, and this is pretty cool because Texas is such a state of wine lovers. It's really cool. We are on the line with Chris Brundrett, and Chris is the co-owner.
There you go.
Yeah, thank you. Chris is the co-founder, director of winemaking of William Chris Vineyards. How you doing?
I'm living the dream. Appreciate you having me on today, right?
Thank you. I appreciate you being part of the podcast. I like the fact that you said living the dream. That is it as a winemaker, isn't it? It's kind of a pinch me thing, right?
It is. It is. And it's, I'm incredibly blessed to not only be a winemaker, but, the leader of our wine company, which is responsible for 94 souls, which, you know, in this day and age, it's a lot of responsibility, but I'm so blessed to be where I'm at and have the team that we have and just, you know, really in 2021 be sitting here talking to you today and can truthfully say I'm living the dream. I wish the times were a little bit different, but, you know, we are incredibly blessed to be where we're at. And I'm happy I woke up on this side of the dirt this morning.
Yeah, we're all kind of there. Thank you. No, I don't normally start with this question, but how many cases are you guys making, just to get an idea?
Oh, so that's a very loaded question. So we're, William Chris Vineyards, which is just one of our four brands, is probably hovers around the 30,000 case mark. But collectively as William Chris Wine Company, we probably produce around 50,000, 60,000 cases.
Okay, good. Gives me an idea at least where you're at. And you're in the town of High, Texas. Am I saying that correctly?
That's correct. High, Texas. H-Y-E.
I never get it right the first time. Thank you.
Well, you're one of the only ones to get high right.
Oh, really?
So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. So one thing I saw on your website, which also I liked, you talk about authentic Texas wine. So what is authentic Texas wine to you?
Oh, gosh. Well, maybe we start at the beginning. You know, what brought Bill or the William part of William, Chris, and I together is, we were both really kind of frustrated at the Texas wine scene. I was headed out to California after graduation and had tasted some really interesting Texas wine. And I thought, you know, there's something really amazing going on here and I don't want to miss it. And quickly I found out that the Texas wine industry 15 years ago was just, I don't want to say barely hanging on, but it was a little bit more than that, but not much more. And it had just been kind of in the same period that it had been for 20 years. And that's just, you know, a bunch of folks that didn't really know how to farm that were, you know, trying to put in vines, but ultimately, you know, some of them were making some good wines. And then, you know, there's a lot of juice just brought in from finished wine from the West Coast. And, you know, people had their little trinket shops And ultimately, I was just incredibly disappointed with the industry. And I thought ultimately, Ray, that I'd made the wrong decision staying in Texas. And then I met my business partner, Bill, and he and I, over a couple of martinis, got so fired up about how we knew that Texas wine could really be something and that nobody was really doing it. They didn't really get it. A lot of the wine companies were just barely struggling, barely hanging on. And, they just were worried about all the trinkets and whatever few wines they had in their wine shops. And that's about it. And we thought, man, we could do such a better experience, and we could share real Texas wine, i.e. Texas wine that was was grown and not made. And when we say real Texas wine or authentic Texas wine, just wine that's grown in the vineyard. And I know that sounds kind of like sounds like an oxymoron. But there's kind of a way to engineer wine and really drive it to taste a certain way. And then there's a way to grow wine and manipulate it as little as possible and really share a sense of place with wine. And I think that ultimately that's what really brought Bill and I together, and that's what drove us. That and having an amazing place for people to work is what drove us together. And I think that it is definitely the mark of a very developed wine region when you can see lots of producers doing that. And we're on chapter 4 right now of the book of producers growing into that. So I think when does that answer your question?
It does.
In a roundabout way?
It does, very well. And I'm assuming you're from Texas originally, is that correct?
I am. My parents, my dad is from Texas. I was actually born in Clarksville, Tennessee, on a military base. But, my family, at least on my father's side, is from Texas. I was raised in Texas from 5 or 6 years old.
And you're kind of close to Austin, close to San Antonio.
Correct. We're almost equidistant. We're an hour west of Austin and an hour and maybe 10 minutes northwest of San Antonio, and very close to 3 hours away from Dallas and Houston area. So right in central Texas.
I wanted to set the scene for our listeners because looking at your website, three particular wines stood out to me that just I happen to have my own favorite towards. I saw on your site Mavedra, Montepulciano, and Tannat. Is this what you're growing there as well as other wines?
It is. I think I want to say for all the research we've done on it, which is, not that much, I think we're probably the second largest Mourvèdre producer in the country. I mean, there's probably, I don't know how much Gallo makes. Maybe they make way more than this. I don't know. But we probably produce about 120, 40, 50 tons of Mourvèdre from the hill country and the high plains. We grow quite a bit of Tannat. We really focus a lot on Sangiovese as well.
Wow.
Montepulciano is another great varietal for Texas. We farm. Our farming operations are mostly in the hill country, which is right around where our winery is located. And then we also have some sister farms and growing partners and vineyards we purchase grapes from in the high plains, which is kind of in the crux of the panhandle, if you could say that, at the very bottom of the panhandle.
Sure, it's just cool to see those wines. You wouldn't normally think, oh, Texas, Montepulciano, come on, that's very cool.
It's pretty wild, and it's so awesome to see the varieties kind of develop over the years too. And I think we're getting smarter and smarter every year as far as what's growing, not only what's growing and living and thriving, and then what's the best wine quality, and then also what does the market bear? It's all you got to take all those things and make sure that you're successful. If you can grow a lot of Tannat, but nobody wants it, it's a different situation.
Sure. You got to sell it in the end. You'd sure like to sit there and drink it, but that doesn't exactly make the circle come full circle, right?
That's right. As one of my mentors, Kim McPherson, told me, Chris, don't fall in love with this shit. You got to sell it. I always hated that term. And then, 10 years later, you look back and you go, God, he was sure right. So he's
never were more honest words spoken. Climate in Texas, from my experience, and I spent some time down there years ago, it can vary wildly. But for that part of the state, you guys are dealing with all kinds of different stuff. What is it like for a growing climate there?
Oh, it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of like, I heard bull riding described one time as, I think Robert O'Keefe said, it's like driving a car down the highway 70 miles an hour and then chunking the steering wheel out the window. It's somewhat comparable to that. I mean, like today it is 65 degrees, a little breeze, you know, just gorgeous outside. You know, 3 days from now, it could be snowing, you know, doubtful that it's snowing, but, you know, it could be 30 degrees, you know, in a week from now, it could be 80. It really could be, you know, the winters, I mean, we have two seasons, you know, winter and summer. But then we have a lot of beautiful days in between, and they're not necessarily consecutive. And, I love Texas. It's where I was, you know, raised. And, you know, it just the most interesting climate because they say if you don't like the weather, just wait, it'll change. And, you know, in the summer, we have a lot of vintage variability as well. I think that is one of the key markers of Texas is the vintage variability. You know, we've had, you know, droughts with 100 days without rain. Last year, I think we had almost 200 days in the high plains without rain,
wow,
which is wild and unseasonable. I mean, yeah, in the high plains, we have, you know, routine 50 mile an hour wind, I would say almost on a biweekly basis.
Oh my.
You know, I was sitting in a Greek wine class a number of years ago, and the teacher said, you know, sometimes there's gusts of up to 40 miles an hour, maybe 50 miles an hour. And I just started laughing out loud. I was like, well, it's like Tuesday in Brownfield in Lubbock area. You know, that's what we're used to. So, and you know, the cherry on top of all that, we have, you know, the potential for late freezes, especially in the high plains. We have hail, you know, toss in the tornado occasionally and, oh yeah, hurricanes, you know, that definitely crop up right around harvest season, which can actually be helpful in the high plains, and then can definitely spit off some rain in the hill country. So, you know, it's it keeps you on your toes as a winemaker for sure, because you can't make the same exact wine every year, in my opinion.
Well, I would think a lot of winemakers have that same attitude of not necessarily wanting to make the same wine after that, because the adventure would be gone, right?
Well, you know, I think more and more people are getting there, Ray, but, you know, and I don't want to say I'm like old and wise now because, you know, all of 37 and I've only had 15 vintages under my belt. But I feel like just making wine in Texas, you can either fight it and say like, you know, I want to make the same exact Cabernet Sauvignon from this vineyard that I did 5 years ago in this wonderful vintage. Like, I just think it's a fool's errand, and to try to make that happen every year, you know, and it's just not what I want to be doing anyways. And I don't think it's the, like you said, it's not the adventure and it's not the path to success that I would like to go. And I love that other path, though, the path less traveled, has led us on to so many different unique wines, like Petitot Natural, we make quite a bit of, and lots of rosé, and, you know, so many other different blends that have really just led us into a great place. And again, like, I can't wait to see what the next 10 years brings us.
Ah, great attitude. You know, I've often referred to winemakers as mad scientists because you guys are. Do you have some pet projects, some experiment? You just mentioned one that you kind of mess with. maybe you go to the wine club, maybe they don't, you know, anything like that?
Sure. We're actually trying to curb down the pet projects because the last decade has been, pet projects and ultimately, you know, we're really having to curb down. If we've kind of said, okay, you know, we bring in, I think as a company, 140 blocks of grapes. So lots of 150 different blocks of grapes. grapes across the state of Texas that are all in different lots and then start getting combined. And, you know, we're kind of looking at if we've got to focus this next decade and how do we make more delicious wine that represents not necessarily just a single vineyard, but maybe an area. And we've been really well known for a lot of our single vineyard wines. But as you can imagine, you can't make, in my opinion, it's a lot tougher to share effectively and educate people about 140 blocks of grapes. It's not realistic. And I think we're a victim of our own success because so many of our fans come up and be like, oh my God, Chris, your Mourvedre is my favorite wine on the planet Earth. We love it. And I go, great, which one? And they're like, the one with the black label on it, you know, and they'll be searching for it. And these are people that buy a lot of wine, you know, and you know, they're searching for, you know, we make 9 different single vineyard Mourvedres. So it's like,
wow.
At some point it's like, oh my gosh, we gotta, why don't we make 3 different single vineyard Mourvedres and then a really great Texas High Plains Mourvedre, you know, I think that's where we're going. Lots of prep projects to say the least.
That's great. Yeah, a little bit of wrangling going on there. About how many acres are you guys farming?
Well, after we're actually in the middle of an acquisition, and I think we're purchasing another vineyard, and I think we'll be up to 85, 88, something like that. Kind of goes up and down. We custom farm for a few folks around us as well, and then are building some vineyards, so it kind of We have a unique operation, especially with Bill's expertise. You know, he's been building and planting vineyards for 40 years, so he's kind of sought after for, you know, some folks coming into the industry. And we kind of have that build them to eventually fly on their own. You know, he'll start them and help them for 5 or 6, 7 years, and then they'll eventually leave us, which is a good thing. We want them to be able to farm on their own, and then we'll continue other ones.
Just had this little bird leaving the nest thing in my head there.
Exactly. And, you know, that's something that's really, really near and dear to Bill and my heart is to, and Andrew, too, my other partner, Andrew Sides, is really building the industry. We want to not only be leaders in the industry, but leaders as a state. You know, we want people to know who we are. And, you know, we're kind of battling for some respect. You know, I think, I don't know how to put it from a DTC perspective. We're doing really well as a state, but lots of folks in Texas buy lots of wine and a lot of it doesn't get out of the state as much. You know, we're not forced to go out in the marketplace like many other wine regions. And, you know, that's a good and bad thing. I mean, it's a great thing from a financial perspective and the ability to build, but it's definitely challenging. I mean, we go sell wine in New York and Chicago, and we're the only guys from Texas there. And our dream is to be able to bring 4 or 5 of our buddies and really start showcasing what Texas is and not be the sole one. So we've got to build the industry.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting to be able to go somewhere and to see, you know, wines from very typical regions and then some from regions you don't think about. But you guys are very big into tourism there. I mean, you're what, in the top 5, if I'm not mistaken?
It's incredible. I mean, like, I've heard numbers of top 2, top 5. I mean, I don't really know how they measure that these days. But, you know, we see upwards of 1,500 people a week.
Wow.
It's incredible. We're reservation only. I mean, we see quite a bit of traffic. We're, you know, pretty much fully committed every Saturday and most Sundays of the year. And, you know, we're very blessed, again, to be from, you know, very close to these major metropolitan areas. And, you know, so many folks are leaving these metropolitan areas and moving out to the Hill Country, which is an incredibly beautiful area. And so we're just inundated with folks, and which is great. You know, and it's almost like a barrier to growth outside of the state, or a hurdle, because if you work hard, you can sell your wine direct and, you know, even in local restaurants, and, you know, it doesn't make it to where you really want to go out and compete in the global marketplace, say in New York or Chicago.
Makes compliance a little bit easier, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Here's my loaded question for the day. Is there such a thing as Texas sparkling?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've made, obviously we're making, we make probably 1,500, as a company, we probably make 2,500 cases of sparkling wine. Lostra Cellars, our sister brand, they make a kind of an undisgorged Petillot wine. And then we make Petillot Natural as well, that is undisgorged and Sansoufri and under the William Kirst label. And it's, I love it. It's one of my favorite wines we make. I personally drink copious amounts of this wine quite often. It's so delicious. Of course, like in Texas, you know, it's warm most days. And so one of my favorite meals is a taco. And we smoke meat all the time on the crush pad, and fresh cabrito off the smoker and some Petillot Natural is probably one of my favorite things in life. And we've also made some Methode Champenois, both in-house where we've done front-to-back process just by hand. We've made a couple hundred cases out of Blanc du Bois, which is it's a variety you've probably never heard of, French-American hybrid, which a bunch of kind of little old retired farmers on the Gulf Coast, which are awesome. There's probably 100 of them that all have like gentlemen's vineyards of like, you know, two to five acres,
sure,
all over the Gulf Coast. They grow a lot of Blanc de Bois.
Hmm.
And it really makes, it's like, if you would have told me 15 years ago, like, hey, you're going to make some French American hybrid wine and you're going to like it, I'd be like, get out of town, man. Like, who are we? Come on. And, but I'm telling you, it is one of the most delicious varieties I've ever had in my life on anywhere around the planet. And, it's very versatile. We can pick it, you know, slightly underripe for sparkling, 16 to 18 bricks, and it's just super green apple and so delicious and has so much complexity. And then, you know, we also make a little bit of still white wine out of it. It goes into a blend, one of our blends called Mary Ruth, which is a blend of mostly Blanc de Bois, Moscato Giallo, and Malvasia Bianca, and just really, really brings in the acidity and the freshness. And I love that variety. And, you know, we probably only bring in about 30 tons of it annually or 20 tons, but it really is a wonderful variety for East Texas and for Texas.
It's amazing. You guys are like spinning on your heels like crazy. You have a lot going on there.
It's a blessing and a curse in Texas in that we literally start harvest sometimes in the beginning of July. In the Gulf Coast, and we have gone as late as middle of October. And so it's a blessing in that we can use our facility almost for three harvests. But, you know, you think about from a winemaking perspective, fitting three harvests into 4 months or 3 months is it's definitely a challenge.
You have no life.
Yeah, we call them harvest widows. That's why I travel a lot, and
yes,
we ski a lot, and you know, try to get out, and from March to October, I have no life.
You know, the industry's changed so much over the years, crazy change, and many things for the good. Packaging has changed quite a bit, though. Bags, boxes, cans, God knows what. Have you guys ventured into that area at all?
A little bit. We have a canned wine company as well. Yes, We Can Wines, that makes a Sway Rosé. We've also done Sway Blanc, which has been, it's been pretty successful. We've had a lot of fun with it, and it's kind of an offshoot company. And it's been a fun alternative package, to say the least. It's a growing company. I hate to say it, we don't, you know, it's not our focus. We're so concerned with our other brands that it sometimes takes a back seat, but it's growing rapidly, and you know, every spring and every summer, so I think our fourth vintage of it, and you know, it's done really well in the marketplace, and it continues to grow in production. And you know, it does make it interesting, though, is like, it doesn't play in the same arena, although I think the quality of the wine, like, there's a lot of garbage in canned wine. I mean, if you pop 10 cans, you'll find so much garbage wine, or just not good wine. And it's almost kind of it almost makes it tougher for us, because we're like, hey, this is really great, high-quality wine that happens to be in a can, and it can compete with anybody in the world. And some, you know, consumers generally like, hey, we just want to drink it, and we want it for this price. And it's a tough game to play in, especially with, you know, competing with, say, the Central Valley. It makes it tough on the price point. But we're getting there. We're getting there. We're figuring it out.
Yeah, interesting. You know, for this time you've been a winemaker, what's the weirdest thing you've seen as a winemaker, whether it be in the cellar or in the vineyard or maybe a crazy experience?
Oh, man, where do I start? there's so much crazy, weird stuff. That is kind of an interesting question. Okay, I'll give you one. So we, this is whatever, 10 years ago, we started a grape stomp, you know, and you know, you cut a barrel in half and you have, you know, people come out and they stomp like I Love Lucy. And we did it for like two years. And I thought, I went to our hospitality team, which is like me and four other people at this time. And I was like, this is the dumbest shit. We're not doing this anymore. Like, I'm done with the whole like song and dance of bringing people into the cellar. And like, this isn't even effective. You know, we're just throwing the grapes away when they leave, and, you know, they're making a t-shirt, and like, it didn't teach people anything. It didn't bring them closer to our brand. You know, like I'm not for this. And, you know, one of our girls, Carol, was amazing. And she said, you know, the next vintage came around and she said, why don't we do a grape punch? And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, we hand punch down so many of our fermentations. We do a lot of macro bin fermentations, even to this day. Not as many as we used to, but at that time we were doing a lot of macro bin fermentation. And, you know, we'd scrub up to our elbows and we'd hand punch down, you know, 50 to 150 bins a day. And she's like, why don't we teach people about what we do? And we'll get folks actually hand punching down in our bins. And I was like, you know what, I can dig on that, you know, and teach people about the hot spots in the bin and, you know, providing the fermentation oxygen and aeration. And it actually was, it went off without a hitch. And it quickly grew, and we did a couple of classes, which I hate to say, as a winemaker in the middle of harvest, is like, let's stop for 3 hours and bring groups of people through in the middle of harvest isn't what we want to do. But I tell you what, it really teaches people amazing things. And one lady, 1 year, I turn around in the middle of this, and, you know, people are drinking a glass of wine, having a fun time, and our wine's expensive, so we don't see like the amazing amount of drunk people that some wineries do. It happens occasionally. And you know, a lady had slipped off, you know, you have to be careful because, you know, she was all in white and everything, and she had slipped off her shirt, and she's just in front of God and everybody punching down grapes. And I was like, maybe we put the shirt back on, you know. And it was definitely one of the craziest things I've seen in the winery in a long time, especially with other people around. And
yeah,
I think that was one of my like whoa days. And she's, you know, she's a great looking lady and everything. And, you know, all the boys were like, I'll work the grape punch, yeah, any day. Right. You know, any day you want, I'll be here.
This please wear white happened, shirts. So. That's great.
Yeah. That's right.
What's interesting, I like that you're talking about education, because that's what we do. And as a winemaker, that's what you do. And it's a big deal to get people to not be intimidated by wine. But interesting question came up a little while ago, and I found it fascinating, is how, as a winemaker, when you're talking to consumers or even friends, how do you describe smells to people?
Oh, gosh. I try to put aromatics in just the simplest terms. To get people, you want to lure somebody in. You know, I think if you go too deep, too fast, especially if you're talking to, you know, if you're talking to a, you know, a sommelier, you know, wine enthusiast that's been into wine for 20 years, you know, and been around the wine game, it's much easier to like dive in into, you know, I was with somebody the other day and I was like, it's kind of chai tea. And he's like, man, I'm totally getting the cardamom. And we were going back and forth and it was great. And if you say cardamom to somebody, like, you know, a lot of people aren't going to pick that up on the, or even understand what that is. And, you know, they don't do the smell kits and all that other good stuff. And so I think that ultimately I start off slow, if that makes sense, and don't try to hit them with too much information. And then I also, like, really try to not dictate to somebody else what our wine, especially our wine, tastes like or smells like, you know, and then they'll kind of wait till I'm asked a bit. You know, I think every wine is done experience, and, like, I don't want to dictate to somebody what experience they should be having. And I definitely, and we don't do it in our tasting room. We actually are anti that in our tasting room. We're like, this wine has aromatics of black cherry and vanilla and hints of cocoa. You know, like, that's not ever said in our tasting room as we're describing wine. We're trying to describe the place. Maybe as a tertiary description, we'll start describing the region and giving some aromatic hints, you know, as a tertiary descriptor. It depends on the person. But I definitely don't like coming out of the gate with that.
Sure. Very good answer. To be able to talk to winemakers, I think winemakers are some of the most fascinating people around, because you guys are fun, and how can you not be happy when you're making wine? But I'm sure you've done plenty of media, plenty of interviews in your career, but what's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, gosh. That's a great question. Okay, I'll give you one, and it's actually... it's actually a lifted question, and I'll do a, or I don't want to do a plug for another podcast, but I listen to a lot of Tim Ferriss.
That's okay.
And he always asks the question, if you were going to have a billboard, you know, one of your sayings on a billboard, like, what would you tell the world? You know, if you had this outside of a college or something like that. And I always love that question, and I love the answers. And I, till this moment, I didn't really think about what my answer to that question would be, but I always appreciate that question. And I think if you're asking me that question,
sure.
I think that my answer would probably be, hope is not a plan. And that means, when I say hope is not a plan, I used to say hope is for losers. And my wife really, really kind of shamed me for that one, and she's like, you gotta be a little bit more positive, and I really never meant it negative. You know, you can have hope for people and wishes, but, like, wishing is not a plan. Hope is not a plan. If we want to go do something, we figure out how to do it, how to accomplish it, and start putting together a plan to go make some of these things happen, whether it's in your personal life or in your business life, or, you know, there's so many aspects of hoping for something, but you can't just, like, wait for it to happen. You've got to go out there and make it happen. And I feel like the more we plan and the more we work towards goals that we set, I think that the better we are, and understand that, you know, sometimes we don't hit all our goals or hit all our plans.
Yeah.
But constantly looking back and checking, and figuring out, like, hey, on the road to get to this accomplishment, like, what does the scenery look like? You know, what does the side of the road look like? What do the trees look like? Describe what are we going to see on the way? How do we know we're going in the right path?
And, yeah, the journey.
You know, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, enjoy the journey. You know, we can't always just say, once I get here, I'll be happy, because that doesn't work.
No.
Enjoy every day.
Very good. Chris, this is really great for us to be able to talk to people from Texas and help spread the word a little bit about what you guys are doing. And I'm sure our listeners would like to learn a little bit more about you. So if you could pass along your website to us so people can check you out, what is that?
Sure. You can check out a couple of them. You can check us out at williamchriswines.com. That's williamchriswines.com. You can also check us out at lostdrawcellars.com. You can follow me on Instagram, IGHYETX. That's I, G as in gamma, HYETX. hit me up on Facebook, all that good stuff. And you can also check us out at yeswecanwines.com.
Cool. Definitely recommend people check you guys out. And Chris, thanks very much for taking some of your time this morning. I appreciate it. And I hope to get down there sometime soon.
Please do. And I'd encourage all your listeners, like, I want to personally invite them to our tasting room. We have, in Texas, especially in the Texas Hill Country, we have one of the most unique wine experiences. We do food and wine pairings. We have a beautiful garden. Come sit in the vines. And so many Texas wineries are doing such a great job. And if you haven't made it out yet, you don't know. You don't know the secret. So it's really cool. I highly recommend for all your listeners, plan a trip to Austin, plan a trip to San Antonio. Some of the most, San Antonio for sure is one of the most underrated cities in the country. But Austin's incredible. Come make it out. Come stay in the Hill Country and check out some amazing parks, some amazing wines, and plan a 4 or 5 day trip because there's a lot to see.
Excellent. I highly recommend it. Chris, thanks very much.
Yeah. Cheers, Ray. Thank you.
Cheers. Learn more by visiting williamchriswines.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Copyright 2020.